Howard's Tavern, Long Island, New York, August 27th, 1776, 2 a.m.
William Howard wakes to find, a British soldier standing over his bed. The redcoat orders the young American to get dressed and marches him downstairs. In the taproom of his family's tavern, William discovers his father, William Howard Sr., standing with three more British light infantrymen, their bayonets fixed. Two British officers are present, and though one wears a cloak, William's father's pretty sure he recognizes him. He is Sir William Howe, Commander-in-Chief of the British forces. Howe asks for a drink of liquor from the bar, and Howard provides. He then questions him about the road beyond the tavern, a low trail through the hills named Jamaica Pass. But more than that, he now requests that the Howards guide the vanguard of his army along the pass. At first, they refuse, but finally Howard Sr. agrees only after they threaten to shoot him. So reluctantly, they set out, leading the column of British troops through a moonless night. And through Jamaica Pass they march, around the flank of the Continental Army, the rebels unaware that 10,000 redcoats will descend upon them with the coming Long Island dawn. This historical close shave is brought to you by Henson Shaving, who we thank for supporting this episode. By the summer of 1776, it appeared as though the American Revolution was on the cusp of success. After the British evacuation of Boston in March, there was almost no royal presence remaining in the colonies between Georgia and Massachusetts, and Whig revolutionaries controlled the levels of power like the militia and the courts. But even the most ardent American patriot acknowledged that King George's response to such a usurpation was unlikely to be meek surrender. Their fears were well-founded. In July 1776, a British fleet of over 100 ships appeared off the coast of New York City. It was King George's answer to the humiliations of the past year. The British seized Staten Island almost without a fight and began landing troops. The primary objectives of their commander, Sir William Howe, were to destroy the main Continental Field Army under George Washington, seize New York, and then open peace negotiations with the cowed and beaten colonists. The Continentals prepared to resist. George Washington kept the main body of his army on Manhattan, then known as York Island. However, a strong detachment of 6,000 men were deployed over the East River to Long Island, where they occupied good defensive positions on Brooklyn Heights and the Heights of Guam. In late August, the British and their Hessian allies, German troops hired by the British, began to ferry across from Staten Island to Long Island. But the Continentals made little effort to resist their landings, deciding instead to remain entrenched on the high ground, with Washington arguing the British presence on Long Island was a feint designed to draw his troops away from New York. But over the space of several days, Howe assembled around 20,000 troops on the southwestern edge of Long Island, while the Continentals still stubbornly kept to the heights, remembering how, the year before, a similar strategy at Bunker Hill had inflicted massive casualties on British attackers. But it's important to remember that back then, the British had marched like little clockwork toy soldiers, in close, slow formations, into a hail of American gunfire. Though the ground had been taken, General Howe knew he could not afford to pay such a high price for another victory. So, in the years since, he had developed new tactics for combating the rebels. The British would no longer attack Continental defenses head-on, instead conducting wide flanking movements and rapid bayonet assaults, ensuring the enemy didn't have time to employ their superior firepower. Long Island was to be the first test of these tactics. Howe himself would lead the flanking force, which included the elite light infantry and grenadier battalions, Scottish Highlanders of the Black Watch, and the 33rd Regiment of Foot. Two of Howe's subordinates, General James Grant and Charles Cornwallis, were to command the remainder of the army, with orders to mount diversionary frontal attacks. August 26th, 9 p.m. The British camp. 10,000 British flanking troops march away with their campfires still burning to help convince the Continentals they were bedding down for the night. Confined to rough, narrow tracks, the column stretches for over 2 miles. They cross the first major obstacle, a bridge over Goose Creek, without meeting resistance. 11 p.m., west of Guam Heights. Pennsylvanian Continentals unwillingly spark the battle after they take aim at several redcoats foraging in a watermelon patch near the Red Lion Inn.
Within 2 hours, a British battalion drives into the Continental pickets near the inn and begins to move up the Gowanus Road towards Brooklyn Heights. Grant's diversionary attack is underway. Thinking the British plan is to cut off the Heights of Guan from the west, a large force of Continentals take the bait and move to meet Grant's attack. Major General William Alexander leads the defense, with the Continentals meeting the British and Hessian advance from hilltops and ditches. One promontory, the highest point on the west of Long Island, becomes a scene of fierce fighting as both sides race to secure it. Grant is an aggressive commander, and while he actually launched his assault too soon, the intensity of the action does help convince Continental commanders that his is the main British attack, while in reality, Howe's knockout blow is winding up 4 miles further east. August 27th, 2 a.m., Jamaica Pass, east of Guan Heights. Having entered their tavern and press-ganged the Howards into guiding his main force, as we saw at the beginning of this episode, Howe and the British column enter Jamaica Pass. The advance, however, feels torturously slow. Repeatedly, the whole long, winding column has to halt while engineers saw down trees to widen the trail for the artillery, axes being forbidden for fear their sound might alert the rebels. The steep, forested sides of the pass seem perfect for the American riflemen the British have heard so much about. Heck, even Howe himself feels sure he must be walking his troops into some sort of ambush. Yet, no riflemen appear. No sharpshooters haunt the looming darkness beneath the trees, for the attention of the Continentals has been drawn further west onto Grant's attack. The British dragoons surprise and capture the five Americans guarding the pass without even firing a shot. Howe's strategic boldness pays off. After 2 tense hours of traversing the pass, the British emerge onto the Bedford Road, running parallel to and behind the rebel lines on the Heights of Guan, now to their south. And having spent 9 hours total marching through the dead of night, Howe permits his men to lie down and rest in the field beside the road. 9 a.m., Bedford, north of Guan Heights. Washington has arrived from New York, drawn by reports of the developing engagement, but he is still unaware that his forces have been outflanked. A further diversionary force of British and Hessians, commanded by General Cornwallis, begins to press the front of the Continental lines at Flatbush Pass, running through the center of the Heights of Guan, contributing to Grant's diversion further west. It seems certain the main British force is still south and west of the Heights, not to the north. And at the same time as Washington arrives on the scene, Howe orders the 2 light cannons at the front of his flanking force to fire. It's the signal that the real attack is underway. 2 Continental Rifle Regiments are the first to discover the trick. They mount an ad hoc defense of the walled fields and small forests and orchards near the hamlet of Bedford, and even manage to ambush a company of British light infantry, but they are soon outflanked and scattered. Panic takes hold, and the main Continental line crumbles, rolled up from east to west. Cornwallis's corps presses their advantage from the front, with both British and German troops relying on rapid movement and use of bayonets, not giving the Continentals a chance to reform their lines as they're driven from Bedford Pass and the Guan Heights toward the Brooklyn Heights and the East River beyond. The only stable part of the Continental line at this point is on the right, the furthest from the British flanking move. And almost until the end of the battle, this mixture of Maryland, Delaware, and Pennsylvanian regiments are unaware of the disaster unfolding on their left, as they fight to hold Grant's aggressive diversion at bay, believing they are checking the main assault. By the time General Alexander realizes the entirety of the line he'd thought was anchoring his left flank is collapsing, it's almost too late. He orders a retreat through a wide mill pond and marsh spreading from Gowanus Creek, now the only route out of British encirclement. Alexander then commands Smallwood's Maryland Regiment to act as a rearguard, numbering only around 270 men. Though now often erroneously known as the Maryland 400, they launch a counterattack against the oncoming British and Hessians. Led by Alexander himself, they mount multiple bayonet charges against overwhelming numbers. The regiment is decimated and Alexander himself captured, but their sacrifice is not in vain, for most of Alexander's division makes it across the Gowanus. 2 p.m., Brooklyn Heights. Any Continentals not killed or captured flood into the second line of defenses, located atop the Brooklyn Heights, overlooking the ferry to New York. Here they rally, while the artillery crowning the fortifications opens fire on the pursuing enemy. Though the inexperienced rebel gunners send their round shot shrieking over the heads of the British rather than scything into their ranks, it is enough to make the nearest of Howe's forces take shelter in a roadway cut into a dip in the ground at the foot of the heights. A short, sharp debate follows about whether to continue the assault. Howe wants to end it, but one British officer, in the heat of action, is said to have, quote, stormed with rage at being stopped. But Howe remained adamant. He will not risk snatching defeat from the jaws of victory by attacking Brooklyn Heights. Even now, the memory of Bunker Hill is still too fresh. And by 3 p.m., the Battle of Long Island was over. For the Continentals, the situation appeared desperate. They were essentially besieged on Brooklyn Heights with the East River to their backs. Though, Washington refused to despair. The day after the battle, he actually reinforced the Heights from across the river. Then, on August 29th, Washington held a council of war and, after a debate, did a bit of a 180 and ordered a nighttime evacuation. This maneuver was every bit as fraught and daring as Howe's flanking march. Under the cover of darkness, the stranded Revolutionary divisions were ferried by platoons and companies across to the safety of New York. Disaster even seemed certain when a mistaken order saw the rear guard march down to the boats, leaving the defenses entirely unmanned. Yet fortune favored the bold. Though the sun began to rise while the evacuation was still underway, a morning fog helped conceal the final withdrawal. And the British awoke the next morning to find the fortification on Brooklyn Heights wholly deserted. Now, Howe's failure to carry on and destroy Washington's army during the Battle of Long Island has been cited as one of history's greatest military blunders. But in truth, the reality is more complex than that. The British and Hessian troops were exhausted, hungry, and low on ammunition after marching all night and fighting for most of the day. The cornered Continentals had found themselves in an excellent defensive position, with artillery and redoubts atop the heights, and continuing the attack would almost certainly have turned the initial battle into a second Bunker Hill. As for the Royal Navy's failure to cut off the Continental escape by river, well, the winds were against the British ships that night, keeping them out of the East River. And even if they had overcome nature itself, they still would have been scoured by Continental artillery and riflemen from both Long Island and Manhattan. Not to mention, if the British had destroyed the Continentals on Brooklyn Heights, it wouldn't really have been the decisive victory Howe sought. Contrary to common belief, most of the Revolutionary forces were stationed on Manhattan, not Long Island. Howe knew this was only the start of the campaign, and he couldn't afford to squander men so early on. The British, for their part, would continue to pursue a war of maneuver, outflanking the Continentals repeatedly, first at Kipps Bay, forcing Washington to evacuate New York itself, then at Pell's Point, which led to the abandonment of Manhattan. The Continentals won their first victory in the field during a large skirmish at Harlem Heights, but withdrew afterward to White Plains. And the campaign culminated in the British and Hessian storming of Fort Washington on Manhattan, one of the worst Continental defeats of the war. That winter, George Washington force-marched through the rain and ice of New Jersey and into Pennsylvania, his army reduced to just a few combat effectives. Howe's campaign had been an almost complete success, though Washington himself had escaped. His army had been all but destroyed, and the popular opinion was that the revolutionaries would now open up peace talks. But that assumption failed to account for the spirit and determination of those fighting for American freedom. Not for the first time or the last, Washington overcame his detractors, leading a brilliant one-week campaign in the depths of winter that resulted in two precious victories at Trenton and Princeton. During the darkest hour, amidst fire, blood, and snow, the flickering light of the revolutionary flame blazed anew, marking the Battle of Long Island and the campaign that followed. Not the end of the war for American independence, but rather barely the beginning.
Granted, not all revolutions need to be as bloody as the War of Independence was. In fact, some go over incredibly smoothly. Like the revolutionary skin-friendly shave you get from a Henson razor! Ha ha! Boom! Talk about a frictionless transition! Give me the prize for that. They have prizes for that, right? When it comes to shaving, Henson knows how important it is to protect your skin. So they made a safety razor, well, you know, like, safer? This shift away from this mass marketing tagline of a smooth shave towards an overall better, skin-friendly shave is what they're all about. And not through, like, gimmicks or quadruple-blade moisturizing strips, but instead through groundbreaking research on the impact shaving has on your skin. Instead of making cheap handles and then charging you a bunch of cash for replacement plastic cartridges that just end up in a landfill, Henson used their expertise to craft a precision-engineered safety razor that just works better. Combine that with how inexpensive the blades are to replace, I think they're like 10 cents a pop, and that they're 100% recyclable, and you get the best shave without a ton of waste or ongoing cost. But do not just take present Matt's word for it. Take a gander at past Matt before he shaved with a Henson razor. Oh, we're doing this again. Okay, yeah, I know I look all scruffy, and you look like if $1 million had soft glowing skin. But when are you going to let me out of this time prison? That guy is such a jokester. And right now, to distract you from my time prison violating chronological law, we can shave a little extra off for you. Of the price, that is. Simply visit hensonshaving.com/extra by clicking the link below or scanning the QR code right here, and use our code extra to get a year's worth of blades with your purchase absolutely free. So, for the most skin-friendly shave of your life, click or scan here. And then once you've smoothed all that out, check out our next video here. Thank you so much to Zeliad's Architectures, Lotus Wolf, Kuya Koi, Joseph Blame, Hunter Z, Dominic Valenciana, Arles Posting, and Angelo Valenciana for being the best legendary patrons.